The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to a new season of The Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast. I'm Alex Kratosky in Florence.
I'm Jemima Kish in London.
And I'm Charles Arthur, also in London.
On this week's show, Microsoft buys handset manufacturer Nokia for a reported 5.4 billion euros. What does this mean for the European tech market now that the US has gobbled up its last mobile hardware manufacturer? We're picking apart the digital implications of the Media Guardian 100, and we'll round out this week's news with our thoughts on life after Steve Ballmer, as the Microsoft CEO steps down and the share prices step up. Finally, this week we're looking at gaming. The Guardian's games maestro, Keith Stewart, will be along to tell us all things Gamescom. Yes, bentornato. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. This week, it was announced that Nokia, the former Finnish technology giant, has been acquired by Microsoft. The 5.4 billion euro deal finishes the job that former CEO Stephen Elop began 2 years ago when he announced the company would abandon its handset operating system in favor of the Windows Phone iOS. Charles, take us through a potted history of Nokia from its origins until now.
Oh, okay. For this, you have to go back to the 19th century when it started out making pulp. And at one time, it was one of the biggest suppliers of toilet paper to the UK. It also made rubber boots. It has made pretty much everything under the sun that's sort of useful in one way or another. It got into electronics in the 1970s, made its first handset in 1982, and then rose to dominate the handset market in the sort of period around 2000. It had about 40% of the whole handset market, and it was one of the first, you could argue the first, to introduce smartphones. It had a dominant share, about 40% of the very small smartphone market in 2006. Then Apple introduced the iPhone in 2007. People's expectations for what a smartphone should be and what a phone could be were completely reset, and Nokia was caught flat-footed. It couldn't change quickly enough, and by the time that Stephen Elop was brought in from Microsoft in September 2010, it was really on the downhill path. Now, the thing about today's announcement is that it's not buying all of Nokia. It's buying Nokia's handset business. It's licensing the Nokia brand for handsets. It's not, however, buying the location and services division, and it's not buying the Nokia Siemens Networks division. So those two will remain as the Nokia in Finland. But the handset business, which is about half of the revenues at present, that will be transferred to Microsoft.
So, Charles, why has Microsoft acquired the handset division? What does this say about the direction that Microsoft wants to take its business strategy?
Microsoft basically is trying to turn itself into Apple. It's trying to be a company which makes the things and writes the software and provides the services. So it already has a very big search engine. It has all the software in terms of the operating system stuff. It does the applications, so it has Office. And now it's also getting into doing handsets. It's already doing tablets in a way which has annoyed a lot of its the OEMs in that space. The only thing it's not making so far is PCs. But of course, it's got a pretty good business ticking over there with all the companies like HP, Dell and Lenovo making PCs. So it does okay out of the Windows business, no need to upset that. But when it comes to the mobile space, the tablets and smartphones, which are where the growth is, it's not doing so well there. So it's got to move in and have some sort of devices there. The strategy it was following of licensing Windows Phone hasn't been working, so it's needed to take a bigger step. And Steve Ballmer's reorganization, which he announced sort of 6 weeks ago or so, which would take Microsoft from being split into organizations, divisions where you'd have the Windows division, which had its own marketing, the Office division with its own marketing, the Xbox and Entertainment Devices division with its own marketing and its own strategies. Those are all going to be turned into horizontal segments. So the marketing function will now cut across the whole of the company, the idea being to get it all to function together. The same works for the software side, for all the engineering side, that you have a single company with a single matrix. very much like what Apple does.
So and, will this be a rebranding, or will we still have the Nokia handsets? Will they continue to be made?
Well, they're licensing the Nokia name for the handsets. I think they'll still continue making the feature phones for a while, but I would not expect it to last more than 5 years. And what they've done is they've bought the brand for the Lumia, which is the smartphones running Windows Phone. They've also bought the brand for Asha, which is a sort of intermediate step between a feature phone and a smartphone. It's not quite classed as a smartphone by the analysts who tot up the numbers, but at the same time, it's got slightly more functionality, sort of touchscreen functionality, slightly more than the feature phones that they have been selling.
What are the implications for other handset manufacturers now that it seems that we've got, you know, one giant in Apple, we've got another giant now with Microsoft, and then we have the panoply, we've got the forest out there of Android-based handsets and others. What will happen to those?
Well, the interesting thing is that Microsoft could have bought any of HTC, the Taiwanese handset maker, BlackBerry, which put itself up for sale last month, or Nokia. It chose to go with Nokia. I think that's got bad implications for BlackBerry because its value is falling. It doesn't seem to be able to find a buyer. There's been no expressions of interest. It can't have a Chinese buyer, I don't think, because I don't think the US government would allow it. Or if it did go ahead, then the US government would throw BlackBerry out from sensitive positions like the Pentagon. And for HTC, it's going to announce its first quarterly loss sometime later this week. And the signs are that once you start losing money in the handset business, things just go south for you. So BlackBerry's been losing money for a while, and you have to say that it's likely to hit a wall sooner rather than later.
Jemima, what do you think of the implications for the European tech industry now that, you know, the last handset manufacturer has been bought by a US company?
Well, it's often said that companies in Europe, once they get to a certain size, they usually sell out to an American company. That's not quite the case with Nokia because its business has been flagging badly, and in a way you could say they're lucky that they've found a buyer. This does seem quite a low price, and Microsoft has got itself a bit of a bargain, basically. But just as with Ericsson in Sweden, Nokia is essential to the kind of ecosystem in Finland, and in terms of the talent and also the finance, the angel funding that comes out of Nokia into that tech startup system is absolutely crucial. And I think in terms of a knock to the confidence of the Finnish tech scene, it's quite notable. But maybe it's a sign for optimism. You know, maybe there's life in the old dog yet. We'll have to wait and see.
I feel that it could see a lot of companies come up with new ideas. I mean, there are plenty of Finnish startups which have really interesting ideas. There's one which does mapping inside buildings using variations, I think, in the Earth's magnetic field. There's I went and visited there last year, and there's plenty going on. There's a lot of things happening, and possibly not having the sort of overhang of big Nokia sitting there with, you know, with the big headquarters and stuff. That perhaps that'll actually free people from and be able to, you know, get them able to think about the future and not feel tied down to this old heritage. I mean, I met the Minister of Economic Affairs, and he said, well, okay, this is the end of a chapter, but, you know, there's lots more to come. We're a pragmatic nation. We can do other things.
Finally, Charles, what would you say are the challenges that Nokia still faces? There's a very concise explanation on the blog based on three charts. I was wondering if you could talk us through that.
Sure. The problem that the handset business still has is that it is, in the analyst's phrase, it's subscale. It's small. And it was big, but it's been winding down. In terms of smartphones, it really is a tiddler. So Apple sells, you know, in a sort of not very good quarter, it's selling sort of 30 million handsets. And Nokia is pretty happy when it's selling 7 in a quarter. So it's just not making much of an impact. And that is the real problem that Microsoft has, is how can it get Nokia selling more handsets? And I suspect the answer is going to be that it's going to go to businesses and try to persuade them to buy, perhaps to swap out their BlackBerries in favour of Windows. But the problem there is Windows Phone is not quite mature enough for enterprises yet.
We can read more analysis on this story by Charles and The Guardian's telecoms correspondent Juliet Garside at theguardian.com/technology. So it was during our Tech Weekly summer hiatus that Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer announced his resignation from the software and hardware giant. Bad timing, Steve. But there's still so much to talk about, and so we wanted to get the first-hand analysis of this story and its implications from our own Charles Arthur. Now, Charles, you are in prime position to talk about this because you basically covered Ballmer's story in your book, Digital Wars. Where did he come from, and is his resignation keeping in character?
His resignation is surprising, but in effect, he was forced out. A hedge fund called ValueAct had bought a big chunk of Microsoft shares and was agitating for more dividends to be paid and for Microsoft to be much more aggressive in the mobile market. And also, they didn't like the cut of Steve Ballmer's jib. They really felt that he should be doing a lot more, or else he should just get the hell out. He came from Harvard. He was actually there with, he met Bill Gates there. He was employee number 30 at Microsoft. He was in the sales function. Took over at the beginning of 2000 and had the sort of misfortune, really, taking over from Bill Gates, who'd been the CEO and became the chairman and chief software architect. He got the problem was he was sort of pitched in at the point where the antitrust trial against Microsoft really took hold, where the judgment came out and the ruling that Microsoft should be split into two. And even though he succeeded in getting it through, piloting through those choppy waters and having it not split up, the whole effect of the antitrust trial and on Microsoft's thinking meant that it was sort of held back for a good few years, and that allowed Apple to grow again, and it let Google slip in through and become a force on the web, really, while Microsoft was distracted by all the antitrust thinking.
And so ultimately, would you say that Ballmer's role at the top was kind of tarnished by something that he effectively got as he arrived into the position he inherited?
He inherited a fantastic pair of monopolies in the shape of Office and Windows, and he looked after those pretty well. But I feel that the weakness was that he always protected them too closely. He didn't let things like the mobile space grow in the way that they needed to. He didn't let them grow as a sort of sui generis, something which is unto itself. So the way that you interact with a smartphone is very different from the way that you interact with a PC. But Microsoft didn't allow that to happen. It didn't create a different strain of software that would let you think in a different way on a smartphone. And that's what Apple did do, and what Google also did with Android versus Chrome OS, which is the PC one. And that was his real failing, I think, was not to drive that and accept that difference between mobile and the PC.
So if that was where everything started to unravel for Microsoft, without that precision, without sort of seeing all of these different elements, these different threads, what role do you think he's played in a positive way? I mean, what will Microsoft lose now that he's going?
He's actually very clever. People don't realize that. And the way that he has managed the whole enterprise side, the big businesses, the big contracts, the ongoing rolling contracts, has actually been very adept. And the fact that he's got Microsoft Office to become a cloud service with Office 365 is something which has gone largely unremarked, and yet is actually a hell of an achievement. Same with the Azure, which is a sort of equivalent to Amazon's S3 and AWS. It's web services online so that you can buy machine capacity, and lots of companies use it. For example, TfL uses it for its services. So he's done very well there, just gradually letting the enterprise business become something which is in the cloud. But where he failed was in not seeing the risks from Apple growing, as it did through digital music, and not seeing the real risk that Google posed through search. And he made a couple of bad decisions around search in 2003. He didn't buy a company called Overture, which was up for sale, which really came up with the idea that is used by Google for AdWords. And had he bought Overture, I think the whole story could have been very different.
Jemima, if we compare these two megaliths, if we take a look at Apple, which has, you know, Steve Jobs at its helm, you know, and he's got his black T-shirt. Exactly.
Yes.
What would Steve do? And then we look at Microsoft, and most people associate Microsoft with Bill Gates still, despite the fact that he's not been at the helm for such a long time. Is there a character, is there a kind of a type, a characterization that Ballmer plays. Is that in some ways what was missed, perhaps? He wasn't that kind of iconic figure.
Well, many people know him for the Monkey Man video where he kind of beat his chest on stage, and it left quite a deep impression in the way that only the internet and video can. The personality of a chief executive obviously shapes the company to some extent, and what Apple has been very good at doing is sort of making people think that it envisions the future, that it knows what's going to happen in the future and creates the product that people want. What it does actually is create products and makes people want them, and therefore creates the future. And Microsoft has never been as convincing in its strategy. It's never been as coherent as that. Its products always seem a little bit confused, and it's actually very good at producing mainstream products. But the messages there seem to get a bit mixed. And with its Xbox One launch, rather than going with the market that it knows that it has, its gamers, it tried to be a kind of, you know, taking over your lounge, being the hub for your home, which was evidently not what its core market wanted. So the message around Microsoft products on the consumer side, I think, is often a bit confused. And, you know, I think the biggest challenge for his successor is going to be to bring that strategy together and to make it seem coherent and encourage innovation at scale as well.
Well, speaking of his successor, there are pretty good rumors, Charles, aren't there, that Nokia's former chief executive, Stephen Elop, will be the next Ballmer, and that his resignation was actually very timely. What's the story there?
So, yes, Stephen Elop came from heading up Microsoft's Office division in September 2010 to take over Nokia. And there were all sorts of rumors at the time of, oh, he's a Trojan horse, he's going to sell Nokia to Microsoft. All the information that we've been getting is that the real serious talking about selling the handset division to Microsoft only began around about sort of end of June, beginning of July. And that's significant because that is when Stephen Elop finally sealed the deal to buy the other 50% of Nokia Siemens Networks. So that meant that Nokia, without the handset business, could stand alone because NSN is profitable, even though the maps business isn't. And that in turn meant that the handset business could be sold to Microsoft. So you could think that he was looking at a long-term way of getting the business ready to sell to Microsoft. There's one thing I would point out. Looking at the numbers, Nokia was probably, if it didn't have this deal, it was probably going to run into cash negative territory sometime in the first quarter of 2014. In other words, might have gone bust. Microsoft is lending at 1.5 billion euros through to January because its debt rating is junk. It couldn't have raised money on the markets, and it had a refinancing coming up at that time in January 2014. So Stephen Elop quite possibly was piloting it towards a sale. But yes, he's a very strong candidate now because he's got experience in the very hard knocks business of making mobile stuff, dealing with the hardware side, which is what Microsoft wants if it's going to be a devices and services business.
It's a massive statement for Microsoft if they had a mobile-first chief executive, if you like, and their shareholders would probably love that.
He's also got the experience, of course, you know, having worked in the Office side. That means he knows Microsoft before, he knows Microsoft from the outside. So he's best placed, really, to give it guidance for the future.
Well, there's ample coverage on this topic that you can read at your leisure on theguardian.com/technology. The Guardian has published its top 100 movers and shakers in this year's UK media scene. Normally not the domain of the technology podcast, yes. This year, we've noticed that the list, in numerical order, has chronicled the rise and rise of digital, rankling a few of the traditional media players who've been pushed down the rankings. Jemima, what is the Media Guardian 100 and how has it been devised? Is it smoke signals?
It's a bit bloody cheeky, actually, to call it the Media Guardian 100 when there's so much technology in it. We've been doing this for years at The Guardian, and it's kind of the top 100 most powerful, influential people in the media industry. So obviously that's why there's so much technology in it now. But they gather a kind of panel of esteemed media pundits, and they all, I don't know, eat cucumber sandwiches and drink tea all afternoon and then decide who should be in the list. If they just listed 100 people, then probably there would be less to argue about. But the fact that they order them in 1 to 100 is where it gets interesting. This year, number one, which is either a cop-out or brilliant, I can't quite decide, is You.
Me? Thank you so much. I'd like to thank the Academy.
Yes.
No, what?
No, the generic You, as in all of us. They didn't really want to say, you know, citizen journalism or any of those kind of archaic phrases. But on this beautifully quaint piece of technology called a newspaper in front of me, they're all listed in great detail. But in the top 10, there are six technologists, loosely interpreting You as one that is, you know, there because of the technology, because that's what empowers people to be more powerful than even Lord Hall, the new Director General of the BBC. Larry Page, number two, of course, co-founder of Google. Dick Costolo, Twitter's chief executive and former stand-up comedian, we learn, at four. Facebook's Uber woman, Sheryl Sandberg, at five. Tim Cook at six. And Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Clocks in Mountains at seven.
Now, very interesting, because each of these people are now trying to create content, except actually Google. Google isn't trying to create content out of all of these organizations that you're describing. The kind of the media scene, as it were, is the content producing market. It indicates a trend, does it not, Charles?
Well, Google is producing content. It's paying bazillions to get people creating content on its YouTube channel. So, yes, it is actually doing that. You could argue that Street View and stuff is creating content. I mean, it's much more these days than just a search engine. It's, the fact that it analyzes a lot of things doesn't mean that it's not trying to be a bit of a media player too.
No, that is a very good point, and I stand corrected. Going back to You, Jemima, I want to raise something that... that you said it's either genius or a cop-out. In 2006, Time magazine in the US said that You was the person of the year. Not you, sorry, but You, as in the royal You, I suppose,
yes,
is what you would
Y-O-U,
call.
Y-O-U, yeah.
So how is this different? What's happened in, you know, in the 7 years since Time magazine said that we were the person of the year, and now Media Guardian 100 has said that we are the most powerful and influential media person or individual in the UK.
So you're saying we're 7 years out of date. Well, to be fair, I think there are several reasons that this is more relevant than ever. Not least the fact that we've all been forced to scrutinise our reliance, our dependency on consumer web products because of the discoveries that have been made around the NSA and the surveillance of non-US citizens and others. By US security agencies. So that forces consumers to reassess their relationship with these companies. Argument A, I'd say, but also the growth of mobile phones, which are a huge driver and changer in behaviours of the way that we consume media.
Charles, if we take 2006 as a benchmark, the first time that we were determined to be awesome, and now, what would you say has changed over the last 7 years that distinguishes the You now and the You then?
Access to connectivity, really. So back then, you know, 2006, there's no iPhone, there's no Android. Nokia has its Symbian smartphones. They're okay, but they're not great. A lot of people are online, but the way that they're online is through the desktop. So if something happens, the bombings in London, which happened in July 2005, it was dramatic that people were able to film from inside the tunnels, but they couldn't sort of broadcast it from inside the tunnels. They couldn't get it out any more quickly than providing it to the BBC, who then broadcast it. If you imagine the same sort of thing happening now, if you look at things like the Arab Spring in spring of 2011, the effects of that, those were all heard through Twitter, through Facebook, through Google, through all sorts of YouTube, which is so essential now in terms of bringing the effects of the gas attack in Syria to international view. So that's the thing that's really changed, is the connectivity. Everyone has that connectivity available to them if they have a smartphone, and even if they just have a feature phone, you can text text to Twitter. There's all sorts of options available at so much less cost and so much more pervasively.
I think we should. It's worth scrutinising some of the decisions behind this list, because Marissa Mayer is at number 57, for example, and Robert Peston, the BBC's business editor, is at 33. Now, obviously, this is UK focused, but even so, Marissa Mayer has done a cracking job with a company that looked like it was, you know, sliding into disaster. So I completely disagree with ranking her that low. There are other people in the list who are, they're in the list because of the company they work for. And Tony Wang is the general manager of Twitter in the UK. But he's largely hidden from public view, as far as I can make out. He has very low public profile yet.
Except Twitter. When Twitter rows about trolling break out, in which case suddenly he's propelled into public view.
Well, in 140 characters and not actually on Channel 4 News, which is would have been a better place for him, but that it might may be another argument.
Well, you can see the list for yourself and find out where you fall at theguardian.com/media. The Guardian's games editor Keith Stewart joins us now in the London studio to talk us through the battle for the living room, which, it seems, is actually out of the hands of the major players. Welcome to the studio, Keith.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Tell me, what is Gamescom? Because it feels like is it a new event?
Yeah, no, Gamescom has actually been around for a number of years. It originally started off as a smaller event in Leipzig and then transferred to Cologne, where it has become this kind of monstrous public video game fan get-together.
And it's the only one, isn't it, that basically has fans able to go in and have access to the games?
Well, I mean, there are other events, obviously, worldwide where fans can get in. The Eurogamer Expo in London in September is a reasonably big one. But the thing about Gamescom is, yes, it's considered a big kind of legitimate industry event like E3. But unlike E3, yes, the public can get in. And this year there were over 300,000 people from, I think, 88 countries came into this, you know, enormous convention centre in Cologne. And there were really, I mean, if you can't imagine what this place looks like. I suppose the closest you can get to is think about, I don't know, Disney World on the most busy day, on the hottest summer day where it's absolutely full of people and every rider's got these 3-hour queues.
You're not really selling it, Keith.
Yeah, I know, really. Not, it sounds a little bit like audience. Tokyo Game Show or any of those types of sort of, like I say, orgasms of the digital senses, just this kind of throbbing digital mass.
Yeah, but it's weird because it's a kind of it's sort of a tribal event. It's very much, to the people that go, they don't think of 3 hours in a queue as being wasted. You know, everyone will have their 3DS, their Nintendo 3DSs with them, so they'll be able to use their Street Pass feature to kind of swap data and puzzles with other people. All of the big booths, like, for example, the Call of Duty Ghost booth, as you're queuing up and walking along, there are all these big screens showing kind of making of videos and interviews. And so it's kind of really for gaming fans is a chance to all meet up and really kind of immerse themselves in this kind of culture of games. It really isn't just like queuing for a bus.
Now, there were a lot of announcements this year from the major players, but we've covered a lot of that on theguardian.com/technology. So I wanted to focus on three specific areas that seem to have been trends that came out of Gamescom this year. The first, you've described it as the rise of the second screen.
Yeah. I mean, it's this idea really that Nintendo tried to capitalize on with the Wii U, and it hasn't really been as successful as they'd hoped. The idea that as well as your TV screen, your console gaming experience can now involve another personal screen as well. Obviously, with the Wii U, it comes with this gamepad, which has a small display on it. But with both the PS4 and with the Xbox One, you'll be able to align your tablet or your smartphone with your console, and certain games will allow content to work on your smartphone or tablet as well. So the two interact. And at Gamescom, this has been an idea for a number of for a number of months, and we've heard lots about it. But at Gamescom, we started seeing games really using it, and there have been some really fascinating uses of this technology.
Keith, gamers have quite an appetite for exploring new technologies and new consumables and kind of plugins, but how does that trend sort of influence the mainstream? Do you think gamers sort of find out what really works and what's interesting, and then that seeps through to the mainstream?
I think so, yeah. I think that's definitely how it works. And we saw how that can go wrong with the Microsoft Xbox One launch event in Seattle earlier this year, where Microsoft tried to bypass gamers and said, look, Xbox One is this amazing entertainment, mainstream TV phenomenon. And they were trying to basically talk to those kind of middle-of-the-road, mass, mainstream consumers and bypass gamers. And that's not how it works, because gamers were kind of furious about that, and all the coverage went negative. Because what happens is, and this is what happened with the Nintendo Wii, gamers are really kind of fired up by the idea. They tell their relatives, they tell their friends, they put it in the context of a family kind of conversation rather than a marketing ploy. And that's how these things grow. So, you know, this whole idea of second screens, what I'm talking about, that's a really complex idea, and Nintendo haven't really described it that well as a marketing push. It needs more gamers to get this thing in their hands and say, you've got to try this. This is a really interesting way of playing games. And I think what's happened at Gamescom is more people have been able to try second screen gaming and kind of understand what it means and what it can do.
So Keith, it's a really interesting idea, isn't it? This way of using, of having an interface, of cooperating, of collaborating, and, you know, stuffing people up when they're trying to get into these games. Would you say that because other industries have been talking about second screen for a little while, would you say that the games industry needs to innovate, needs to get its hands on it first before other industries like television, like cinema, can actually start to play around with the possibilities?
I think so. I mean, I think fundamentally when people play games, they're in a playful mood, and I think they're more receptive to different forms of interface and interplay. Obviously, there have been lots of televisual experiments with second screens, and you know, lots of the big television media companies in Holland, which is really advanced in this kind of thinking, are toying with second screen interplay between what you see on television and your tablet. But I think what games do is kind of fire the imagination in a very different way. Like, one really good example at Gamescom was a game called Dead Rising 3, which is a kind of a zombie survival game. But you can tie in your smartphone to the game. So when you receive missions in the game, they actually come to you via your phone. So your phone, the application will actually make a noise as though your phone is ringing, and you pick it up and you say it and you answer it, and the game will give you a mission. So it's bringing the world of Dead Rising, it's bringing this kind of zombie apocalypse world into your hand. It's much more personal, and it's much more kind of open to the imagination, I think. And so I think, yeah, games can do stuff with this technology which is beyond the way that we usually use tablets. And I think, you know, television probably does have things to learn, and I think it will make people more receptive to the idea.
Well, that segues nicely into the second trend that you mentioned, which is, you've described it as an era of nonverbal communication between gamers and game characters. Even more immersion in a way that you wouldn't even necessarily need an interface. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is verbal. I mean, what it is basically is there's a new era of games coming, I think, which rely heavily on things like the Microsoft Kinect device, which is going to be staple mandatory part of the Xbox One. In the Xbox 360, this motion control device, which puts a camera in your living room and tracks your movement, it was an optional thing with Xbox 360, so not lots of people used it. But with Xbox One, it's going to be there all the time. You can switch it off if you want, but if it's on, and developers know that you have it, and therefore they can support it in interesting ways. And I think one of the interesting ways we're going to see it used is because the fidelity is so good, because it can track something like 17 facial expressions, and it's got a microphone so it can hear you talk. I think one of the things we're going to start seeing, it's a kind of emotional interplay between you and characters on screen. A really nice, simple way that we saw this being used at Gamescom was in the game Zoo Tycoon, which is developed by Frontier in the UK. This is a game where you kind of run a zoo and you have to look after all your animals. But there's a little feature in it where on the Xbox One, you can go to the monkeys in your zoo and you can pull faces at the Kinect camera, and the monkeys will kind of mimic the faces that you make. So you have this kind of nice little interplay between you and the characters. Again, in the new Pokemon game, Pokemon X and Y, which is coming out in October, the Pokemon will make faces to you, the little monsters that you have to collect, and you get to mimic those, and you get judged on how close you are. Also, there's this sense that we're going to be talking more to characters as well. So that is verbal communication, but it's just forms of communication which don't use the controller, which and about establishing a relationship with the characters on screen. Jesse Schell, a really well-known and really well-respected game designer and author, talks about this whole era of in the future, we might actually communicate with our game avatars in a game like Warcraft. And we might share, instead of seeing them as an extension of ourselves into the game world, we might actually see them as friends. So games become like buddy, sort of buddy movies, so that we actually discuss things with our avatars. We actually discuss our plans for the next day, discuss our raids with our avatars, and, you know, combining AI with you know, receptive audio communications will kind of bring about this new era of emotional interplay between characters. And Jesse has this really nice idea that I really want to talk about, with that one day we might get to the point where we actually pass down game avatars from parents to children. So then parents get older, instead of like passing down a watch, you might well pass down your avatar in a game like Warcraft. And because the avatar,
I'm thinking of this is starting to sound like some of the futuristic Japanese anime the 90s, Ghost in the Shell, and all of that. Kind of thing.
Exactly. But that is going to happen. Jesse Schell says that you know in the future, the way that we learn about our families might not be from, you know, from artifacts and from dry census things online, but it might be from avatars that have been passed down through generations who have been on video game virtual journeys with people, and they've passed down their avatars, and the avatars then tell the new owners about what their parents did and what their parents told them. So it's a kind of a weird fireside chat mythology thing that may happen with games going forward.
Thank you, Keith. You can follow all the Gamescom coverage from this year's event at theguardian.com/technology. That's all we have for you this week. Thank you very much for listening. Next week, it's a happy marriage between science and technology when Alok Jha asks me some difficult questions about my most recent book. Thanks this week to our amazing podcast team, Jemima Kish, Charles Arthur, and Keith Stewart in the London studio, and this week's Tech Weekly producer, Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kwiatkowski. We'll be back next week. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.